Questions?
So this is probably not very responsible of you, but I kind of just assumed that the homework policy is the same as it was for UNM.
Yeah.
Turn in when we get done, kind of thing.
So the policy is they're due on the following day, unless you're really nice to me. And it implies you smile sweetly and you say, "Will you take this late?" Which everyone's guilty of, right? No one turned it in on time. So yes, the policy is the same as E&M. It's due on the following period. Other questions? Okay, so kind of where are we? So we have these basic ideas that quantum mechanics is different from normal mechanics in that we've decided now that particles don't exist. Basically, everything's a wave. When we think about something like a particle, really what's happening is kind of like the dit on a telegraph line, right? So there's some confined region that there's electromagnetic stuff that's traveling down that wire. And that's really what's happening when we think this particle is falling. It doesn't have a location, it has a range of possible locations. But if you figure out what the range of possible locations are for anything that's macroscopic, it's incredibly small, and so classical mechanics still manages to be the case. But if we're talking about, and this is, as I say, so quantum mechanics is true of cars, it's true of electrons, but it only kind of becomes important when we're talking about low mass objects. So even things like molecules are typically massive enough that they mostly seem to be following classical mechanics. But when we start talking about electrons in particular, their wave properties become pretty manifest. But people have shown, for example, interference properties of molecules. It's just trickier to do than it is for electrons. So electron interference goes back to like the 20s or something like that. Okay, so the idea then is that for every physical operator, for every physical quantity, we're going to have a corresponding operator. And these are the ones that we're going to be seeing again and again and again. Eventually, we'll add angular momentum to this list. But obviously, we need to go beyond two dimensions if we're going to have angular momentum. What we kind of mean classically then by the position of a particle is kind of the center of that blob that really is this telegraph dit that's going on the wire. So we look at the average position, and that we can calculate by that sort of setup. Now we get lazy, and it takes a lot of work to write all of that stuff. So we have this abbreviated notation for calculating these sorts of integrals. And you kind of really have to get used to seeing this and knowing that it really is an integral that's just hidden. Okay, so that was where we were on the first day. Last time we proved three theorems, or mostly proved three theorems. Probability better be conserved. It always has to add up to one. And so just like there was a conservation law that we called the continuity equation for charge, there better be a continuity equation for probability. So this is the probability density, this is the current density, and in E&M we had that the time derivative of rho plus the divergence of J was zero. Well, we only have one dimension, so the divergence is down to just the derivative. And you can think about this J as being a current of probability, a flow of probability. Now, if it's a flow of probability, it better be real. And boy, it doesn't look very real. But I can tell you that in fact, if you calculate that quantity out, it's guaranteed to be real. And it's basically then the probability, the flow of probability at any particular spot. So the only way the probability can increase in this interval between A and B is because more stuff is flowing in at A than is flowing out at B. And that's simply that statement. In order to make classical mechanics work, we need that F equals ma, that is to say that the time rate of change in the momentum is equal to the force, and on average, that's going to be true. And we need that the velocity is basically the velocity, and on average, that's going to be the case. So these theorems here, their purpose is mostly to show that the classical mechanics still mostly works. We're not actually going to be seeing these again in practical sorts of situations. Along the way, we did prove some lemmas, and those we will see again. In particular, this lemma here, which is basically just this one, remembering that P has an I in it, so when we take its complex conjugate, it's going to produce a canceling minus sign. This statement here saying that the operator can either operate on this or it can operate on that, and we get the same answer, that's going to be a very common sort of situation. Back in E&M, and I imagine in Fourier series, you talked about separation of variables. So we have, in general, a wave function that depends on position and time, and we kind of have this hope. Really, the only way we can solve these sorts of problems is if it turns out that that function factors. So we have a function that just depends on time and a function that just depends on space. And if we plug and chug this through, we find out that the time dependence is just this nice exponential, and the space part has to satisfy this equation, which we now call the time-independent Schrodinger equation. H psi equals E psi, as opposed to H psi being the I times H bar and the time derivative of psi. So on to a physical problem. It's not real physical, but we consider the case where we have impenetrable walls at 0 and L, no other forces present, so the potential is 0. And we solve Schrodinger's equation, and we found these solutions. We had boundary conditions that the wave function had to be 0 at 0 and L, which is how we ended up with just sines and just these values of wavelength, so that we had an integer number of half wavelengths inside the box. This was the corresponding energy and frequency, and then this is the corresponding total wave function. Questions? Okay. So this pretty simple example has pretty much all of the characteristics of any example, and so we're going to spend some time talking about it. And basically all of the properties we're talking about for this simple case are going to apply to every other problem we're going to see. Okay, so let's start by talking about superposition. Is the sum of solutions a solution? And the answer is kind of yes and no. If we think about psi 1, and what I mean by psi 1, of course, is where I put in the ground state, the smallest possible value for k. If I look at psi 1 plus psi 2, and I try and take two derivatives of it and multiply it by the potential, of course the potential is 0. Of course, what I'm going to get is h psi 1 plus h psi 2, and that's going to be the corresponding energies, and it does not equal something times what we started with, right? So an eigenfunction means that if you operate on it with the function h or any operator, you get back a multiple of whatever you started with. So, not equal. Okay, so we don't have superposition for the time-independent wave functions, but if we look at the fully time-dependent equation, here we're going to get, if we just follow this through pretty much the same, we're going to get E1 times psi 1 double bar plus E2 times psi double bar. And the question is, of course, does this equal I H bar times the time derivative of that function? And it does, because if we take the time derivative of these things. So we're going to have, for example, I h bar, the time derivative of e to the minus I, the energy of the whatever state we're talking about, time divided by h bar. If we do that, of course, we take the time derivative, then all of this stuff comes down. The h bars cancel, minus I times I is 1. And we do just get energy times that same function back. So what we get here is, in fact, then just E1 times psi 1 plus E2 times psi 2. Okay, so this and this produce the same answer. So in fact, the superposition of the time-dependent solutions is a solution. And I hope it's maybe not even worth bothering to say, is that we certainly have linearity. That is to say, if psi is a solution, then 5 times psi is just as much a solution. And it doesn't matter then whether we're talking about the time-independent solution or the time-dependent solution, right? That the 5 would just come out of both sides and everything would be fair game. So we have superposition only if we're bothering to include the full time dependence, not if we just have the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Now, if we look at these wave functions, let's look at them one after another. The ground state wave function has just a half wave between 0 and L. The And so they go. And these things aren't literally even or odd the way I've set them up, because the value of the function here is something, but the value of the function over there is 0, right? But if instead of using the origin here, if I think about the origin right in the middle, then these things are either even or odd, and they alternate, right? So this one is even, and this one's odd, and this one's even, etc. Sometimes, in order to make that evident, instead of choosing 0 to L, we'll choose the boundaries between minus A and A, where, of course, now 2A is equal to L. And I comment that this is not what A means in the book, right? So in the book, they're going to use A for L. But it's obviously not a particularly big deal. One reason we don't do that is writing down the answer becomes trickier, right? Because if this is the origin, then this is a cosine function, and this is a sine function, and this is a cosine function. So here I could write down all of these equations really pretty quickly, and if I have to write them down in terms of sines and cosines, it's going to become kind of a mess. But it's important to remember that even or oddness. Now, because of that even or oddness, what is that? Right, so again, if we really, so this is going to be the square root of 2 over L. We use K1, X, and this is the square root of 2 over L. Never to be written out again. So the integrand is the product of something that's even and odd. So the integrand is odd. And what is the integral, though? So an integral can't be either even or odd, right? Because it's a number. To be even or odd, you have to be a function. So what's this integral? What number?
Zero,
right? When in doubt, guess 0 and then guess 1, right? And then say, ooh. So that has to be 0. because the integrand is odd, if we express it in terms of minus a to a as opposed to 0 to l, and the integral of an odd function is going to be 0. And this is all, again, familiar stuff from Fourier series, right, where you showed that the sines and cosines were orthogonal.
The notation there is similar to the one where you had the f, q, g thing, right?
Ah, yes. So here q is equal to 1, so I didn't bother to write it. And of course, since sine is real, I didn't bother to take its complex conjugate. Okay, so if we think this through, because of what we learned in Fourier series, we know that all of these things are orthogonal. So in general, those integrals are either going to be 0 or 1. They're only going to be 1 if n is equal to m, that is to say if we're talking about exactly the same wave function. And the only reason they're 1 in that case is we made them 1, right? We figured out what this constant was that needed to be in order to give the integral being 1. We normalized the wave function. Okay, so what we've learned here is because the forces are symmetric, what happens is the wave functions are either even or odd. And they alternate. So it goes even, odd. And that would be true of any time the force situation was symmetric, then the corresponding wave functions would alternate even or odd. And the ground state, the one that has the smallest energy, in this case n equals 1, is always even. Okay, well, pretty soon after we did this sort of stuff, we started worried about Fourier's trick. And Fourier's trick goes under the name completeness. And you remember Fourier's trick was the claim that I could write any old function as a combination of these functions. So I could take any old function of x and I could write it as a superposition of these wave functions. And the way we could figure out the values for these cn's was by dotting, as it were, multiplying both sides by psi m and doing an integral. Okay, so if I multiplied, let's do this generally. These things are real, so it doesn't matter. But let's actually multiply both sides by psi m complex conjugate. And then let's integrate. And I'll write this 0 to infinity, but the wave functions are 0 outside of where they aren't. So kind of doesn't matter. So what we've got here is psi m f is equal to the sum of cn, and then we have all of these integrals to do. But all of those integrals are going to be 0, except the particular case when n is equal to m. So the only surviving term is going to be whatever we chose the value of m to be when we multiplied. Okay, so we'd like to have some sort of meaning to these kind of arbitrary coefficients cm. Now in E&M they meant basically nothing, right? They were just whatever was required. But here we're going to have actually some sort of kind of physical interpretation for what these coefficients mean. So the first thing we're going to want to show is that if f is normalized, and of course, what normalization means is if I integrate it with itself, I get 1. Okay, so let's do that. It's going to look pretty ugly. So this is going to be the integral from 0 to infinity. And then I want to add up all of these c's times psi's, complex conjugate, and I want to add up all of these c's times psi dx. Now, I didn't put any subscripts on it because these sums are totally independent, right? So whatever I use to add these, I'm not using the same one to add those. And I can call that anything I want. So I could call it m, for example. Or I could call it n, for example. It doesn't really matter what I call it. Okay, so all of those sums come outside of the integrals. So we have a double sum. And these things are constants, so they can come outside of the integral. And what I'm left over with is that. And those things are all 0 or 1. The only time they're equal to 1 is when m equals n. So this is going to end up being the sum of cn squared. Cn squared because when m equals n, then complex conjugate times the base number is what we call the absolute value. Okay, so these cn's all add up to 1, and that means they have a chance of being probabilities. Right? Probabilities have to add up to 1, and what we're about to show is that a useful interpretation of them is they are the probability that the wave function has energy that corresponds to En. Okay, so Griffith objects to this language, but it's the language that everyone would use. I'm going to say that basically Cn squared is the probability that that you would detect this energy if you measured it. Okay, so to make that, if that is the case, if Cm when it's squared is the probability that it has some energy, then the average energy should be add up the probability of that energy times the corresponding energy. So is that in fact true? Well, what the average value of the energy would be that, I guess we called this thing F. It would be the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with that function. Okay, so let's write out this integral again. So I have the sums of the Cn, Psi n complex conjugated. And I've got the Hamiltonian, and I've got the sum of the Cm, Psi m, and I've got dx. And it's going to work pretty much the same way. Remember that when the Hamiltonian hits this wave function, it just produces a multiple of that wave function, right? H psi equals E psi. So that when H operates on psi m, it's going to give us En times psi n. So if we write out what we've got here, we've got a double sum, this sum and that sum. We've got Cn complex conjugated, we've got Cm, and now I guess these are actually m's. Here we have Em, and these integrals are all going to be 0 or 1. So hope you can see that's pretty much the case. Okay, so we've got Fourier's trick going for us in just the usual way. And using Fourier's trick, we can expand, we can have any old possible state to work with. Okay. So let's think about the initial value problem. If I specify that the electron, the blob of electron, looks kind of like that. How will that blob move in the future? How can I solve that problem? Okay, so this is at time equals 0. So let me call whatever this blob is, let me call this f of x. And we know that we can write that f of x as the sum of these coefficients times the corresponding size, where these coefficients are, and I'll call these things overlap integrals sometimes, those are exactly that quantity. It's certainly an integral, and it's the integral of two different functions, and it's kind of big if they have the same values. Well, I mean, okay, so what? What we really care about is how things are going to be in the future. How are we going to figure out where things are in the future? And the resulting equation better satisfies Schrodinger's equation, namely the time-dependent Schrodinger's equation. And I claim that the following is a solution. So this is a solution which starts out looking just like this and also satisfies Schrodinger's equation for future times. So all I do is tack on those exponential factors. So if I hit both sides of this with the Hamiltonian, and again, what has to be the case is this better be equal to I h bar times the time derivative of that function. So if I hit h bar with this thing, what's going to happen is I'm going to get lots of ens. And let me bring the Cn out front, I guess. Cn, En, Psi n, e to the minus I, omega n, t. And that's exactly what I get here, right? Because if I take the time derivative of this, it's going to bring down exactly that same factor. So this, I've written this so many different times, but it's important enough to write it once, right? So this function, where we take these coefficients that we found at time equals zero and we use them in the future, that is going to be a perfectly good solution to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. That is to say, we can use that double-barred psi to show how that lump is going to evolve in time. Okay, so we could do this with a blob that looks kind of like that, but things would get messy pretty fast. So let's do about the simplest possible linear combination and kind of see how it's going to work. So let's consider the case where our function starts out to be just the simplest possible linear combination of the ground state and the first excited state. Now, the first thing I need to do is to normalize this, right? Which means I need to multiply this by some overall factor A so that if I take the total probability, F overlap with F, I get 1. So we need to figure out what value of A is going to work. Okay, so let's do it, right? So we plug in here A psi 1 plus psi 2, and we plug in here A of psi 1 plus psi 2. So what we've got then, and we'll write this as an integral, only it's only non-zero in that range, so we can do it, restrict ourselves to that. So we have A complex conjugate, psi 1 complex conjugate plus psi 2 complex conjugate times A psi 1 plus psi 2. And of course, these are constants. They can come outside of the integral. You put, multiply a number times its complex conjugate and get the magnitude squared. And then we're going to have the integral of lots of terms, right? So we're going to have this times this. We're going to have that times that. going to have this times that. And finally, we're going to have that times that. And these things are all simple, right? This thing here is, if we go to the more compact notation, it's that, and it's equal to 1. And same thing here, this is that, and it's equal to 1. And these things here are equal to 0. So of these four terms, two of them are 0, two of them are 1. So what we get out of this is the magnitude of a squared times 2. So apparently, a wants to be 1 over the square root of 2. Now, a could be other things too. I mean, you can take lots of square roots. That's a perfectly good square root. That's a perfectly good square root. But, you know, why would you bother, right? Might as well choose a to look as nice as possible. But there's nothing wrong with those other choices. So maybe to say this a little bit more compactly, you could tack on, if you wanted to, anything that was like e to the I phi, because if you take this combination of it, psi star psi, you're going to get e to the I phi times e to the minus I phi, and it's going to cancel out. Okay, so this is called the overall phase factor. And it's going to turn out to be totally unimportant. It doesn't, whatever you choose, it doesn't affect anything. And so pretty much always going to choose it to be 1. There's no harm in choosing it the other things. It just makes the equations unnecessarily complicated. It gives you exactly the same answer at the end. Okay, so kind of qualitatively, what does the result look like? So now when we look at our full time-dependent problem, we're going to have 1 over the square root of 2, psi 1 at its frequency, plus psi 2 times its frequency. And, I don't know, just for fun, let's pull out, say, this term here. So if I pull that out, I'm going to have, you know, a canceling term that is going to be plus omega 1. Now, in terms of calculating, say, the probability density, which is, of course, that, this factor here is going to cancel out. So we might as well concentrate our attention on this term here. And, of course, at time equals 0, that's just going to be psi 1 plus psi 2. So let's, you know, kind of qualitatively take a look at what psi 1 plus psi 2 is going to be. So here is psi 1, here is psi 2. If I add those things together, here they're both positive, so I'm going to get a particularly big result. Here I'm going to get some, I don't know, kind of cancellation, at least partial cancellation. Now if we wait long enough, this factor, which starts out as being 1, it'll rotate around until it's minus 1. And so then we'll have psi 1 minus psi 2. And it'll look just the opposite, right? Because now we'll be subtracting them here and adding them there. And we'll have something that looks like this. Okay, so that's kind of qualitatively how it works. How does it work exactly? So you've got that little sheet in front of you. So kind of the first problem we have if we use Mathematica for this particular problem is how do I plot a function between 0 and L? I mean, I can plot a function between 0 and 621, but I can't plot it between 0 and L. At least Mathematica can. It needs to have numbers to plot. So I could choose L to be, say, an angstrom or something like that. That might be a realistic value. And I could plot things as a function of time. But I know that's kind of not satisfying. I mean, if the labels of this graph are all tiny numbers, it's going to look kind of funny. So a better possibility is to find a, instead of plotting x, to plot a dimensionless version of x, let me call it x prime, which is the physical distance divided by L. So x prime is now guaranteed to go from 0 to 1. And the same thing kind of applies to times. If we make this a real problem with, say, an electron that's around an atom, then the times are going to be all in nanoseconds, which are not very convenient to deal with. So we can make kind of a dimensionless version of time by dividing our times by a convenient number. Same thing applies to energies. Why have energies that are some incredibly small number? Let's divide our energies by an appropriate energy unit. Well, kind of what's the most convenient choice of units, LT and E, which are going to make our equations look nice? And, you know, kind of the answer turns out to be Schrodinger's equation has this h bar squared over 2m. We can just kind of make that thing be 1. So I can make all of this stuff by proper choice of units to be 1. So that these dimensionless versions of the energy are just pi squared times n squared. And I can make it then so the dimensionless version of these frequencies, this is basically making h bar 1, are going to be pi squared times n squared. So this process of going to dimensionless coordinates, it's talked about a bit on those websites I cited. It's key both in order to plot these things as functions and in order to, kind of make progress. It's also very convenient when you're doing your algebra if you don't have all of these kind of ugly terms to deal with. Okay, so if you look at the stuff that you've got, here what I've done is I've written that function, and it looks like what I've done is I've set L equal to 1. But I would say really what I've done is instead of plotting x, I've plotted x divided by L, which kind of seems to make the L disappear. So here is then the corresponding sum function where I have psi 1 times this exponential plus psi 2 times that exponential. So, and here I'm going to plot the absolute value, so this is the probability density, as a function of time. And you can see it works pretty much like what you would expect, right? The particle is mostly on one side of the box, and then it goes mostly on the other side of the box. And it's just alternating between those two spots. Okay, so we chose here about the simplest possible linear combination. We could, there's nothing to keep us from doing it. We could make a little blob of probability that would just bounce back and forth, but it would take a whole lot more work. And it turns out that if we did that problem, that blob would in the end distribute itself over space. It wouldn't remain a blob. And basically the reason for that is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, there would be some variation in velocities, so there'd be kind of some fast particles and some slow particles, so over time that blob would kind of break apart into a variety of stuff. Okay. So also on your sheet, I mean, if we really wanted to include the L, we could. And on the top of that little sheet, I've confirmed, if we leave in the L's, how the average position is going to change in time. Okay, so, I know Mathematica was good for doing this sort of animated plot, but let's see if we can kind of get the same answer if we just look at the expectation value. Okay, so let's try and make a plot of the average location of that particle. Right, so here's zero, and here's L, and here's time. And it started out having a kind of on average a pretty small value of L, and then it moved over to having a relatively big value of L. So I claim that is oscillating about the middle of the box, that the average position of this particle kind of has that sort of behavior. So let's see if we can derive that with our own algebra as opposed to mostly Mathematica's algebra. Okay, so the wave function, and we bring back all of the L's at this time, so we do it right at least once. So this was the normalization factor, and then we had the normalization factor of the individual signs, and the ground state had n equals 1, okay, and we'll write this out, get some shorthands that we're going to need in the future. So what we have then, oops, so this wanted to be as a function of time, so I wanted to have my e to the minus I, the corresponding omega, and in general, I guess I just erased it, the energies of these states are h bar squared pi squared n squared divided by 2ml squared, and so the corresponding omegas are, so these things are energies divided by h bar, so it's just one h bar less. Okay, so let's calculate the expectation value of this wave function. Okay, so we've got this combination that is 1 over the square root of 2 psi 1 plus psi 2. Oops, I keep forgetting my exponential factors. Then we've got our x, and then we've got that same thing. And it's kind of off to the races, right? So these things are overall factors. Two of them are going to come outside of the integral. We're going to have a 1/2. We're going to have that term times that term. Remember that this one is complex conjugated. So we're going to have plus I omega, and it's going to cancel out that one. So we're just going to have, in the end, psi 1 x psi 1. And the same thing is going to be true when we do that, right? This is complex conjugated, so it's going to be plus I omega 2. This one's minus I omega 2, so when we multiply them together, we just get 1. Okay, so those were the easy terms. How about this term here? So that term there is going to have a psi 1 and a psi 2. And this term is going to be complex conjugated, so it's going to be plus I omega. And those things just come outside of the integrals. So this is going to be I omega, omega 1 minus omega 2 times time. And finally, we've got this term here. So that's psi 2, psi 1, oops, exponential term. And now this term here is going to come out plus. So this is going to be I omega 2 minus omega 1 time. So what's the value of that term?
Zero.
Nope. So psi 1 looks kind of like that, and of course if I square it, it looks pretty much like that. What's kind of the average value of x? L over 2, yep. So you do this integral, you're going to get L over 2. Okay, so psi 2 looks like this, and if I square it, it looks like this. What's the value of this integral? Yeah, so for any of these functions, on average, the particle is going to be as much on one side as it is on the other, and so the expectation value of x is going to be L over 2. And we can do those integrals if we really wanted to, but we don't. So let's take a look at these two terms, because this is a trick that we're going to be doing more frequently than not. So what's the relationship between this and this? And I don't mean for this particular case, but for any psi 1 and psi 2. And yeah, they're just complex conjugates of each other, right? So if I write this down, this is the integral of psi 1 complex conjugated psi 2 dx. So if I take this thing and I complex conjugate it, the complex conjugate of the complex conjugate is the function, and that's just that. So in general, if you take f, g, complex conjugate, it's the same thing as GF. And the reason for that kind of hullabaloo is this term here is also the complex conjugate of that term there. So this whole term is the complex conjugate of that term there. And if you think about it, that had to be the case. Because the one thing we know for sure is the expectation value of x has to be real. And of course, this is real and this is real, so these two things, they have to be real. They have to have canceling imaginary parts. And that's exactly what's required, right? Okay, so if we take, and again, we're thinking about this generically. If I take Q and I add Q complex conjugate to it, what do I get? So this Q, it might be A plus I times B, and this would then be A minus IB, and so what I get is 2A. So what I get in general then is twice the real part of Q. So I could write these two terms together, if I wanted to, as twice the real part of psi 1 x psi 2 times e to the, and then this exponential, that exponential factor. Okay, so now we actually have to do an integral, right? Because there really isn't any simple way of doing this integral. Psi by itself is even, psi 2 is odd, but when I multiply psi 2 times x, it's going to be even. So it's not going to be zero, right? It's not an even-odd game. So I actually have to calculate that integral, and you find that integral calculated on your little cheat sheet, having Mathematica do it. It's not a super hard integral to do. I mean, it's just some sines and an x. It's something that you presumably did in calculus too, at least could have done in calculus too. And it's minus 16, 9 pi squared times L. It better have an L in it because it better have the units of length. Okay, so L over 2 and L over 2 is L. If I multiply it by a half, I get half of L, right? Which makes sense. It's oscillating about the midpoint of the box. And then we have twice the real part of a number that is real, right? This minus 16 over 9 pi squared L times e to the I omega 1 minus omega 2 t. Well, this is real. It can come outside of that. So we've got L over 2 minus 32 over 9 pi squared all times L. And the real part of that is cosine of omega 1 minus omega 2 t. Okay, so the average value of the average position of the particle is oscillating sinusoidally. Okay. So first of all, kind of the main point of this lecture is if you have the initial value problem, if somebody specifies what psi is to start, how you find out the future is by Fourier's trick, writing f as a sum of these solutions that we found, and then all you need to do is to tack on the appropriate time dependence to get what the future is. Yes?
So when you have that cosine of omega 1 minus omega 2 t, the t's inside of the cosine.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit lazy. It pretty much has to be, but it is technically wrong not to do that. So the other thing that we've seen is for this particular problem, we had even and odd states, we had orthogonality, we had completeness, and my claim was that that's kind of always, well, my claim is that, yes, that is always the case if we have a symmetric force. So I'm not going to prove that as a mathematical theorem. I'm going to prove that by making you sick and tired of seeing it proved. So if we go from no force, what's kind of the next easiest problem to solve? And that's our friend, the simple harmonic oscillator. So that's the second part of this chapter. And you can see why it came second as opposed to first. Now we have a real differential equation to solve, right? Before we just had psi double prime being proportional to psi, which is a differential equation you could solve as freshmen. So now we're going to have a big, ugly differential equation to solve in order to get these solutions. And interestingly enough, there is a tricky, fast way of getting these solutions. But tricky fast ways, they come second, right? First we do it the ugly hard way. Okay. That's all she wrote.